Okay, so we shall begin. For those of you who haven't got a Majjhima Nikaya book, this, on the table there is some printed copies of the sutra we're going to do today, which is the Chula Vedana Sutra. And the reason why I've chosen this one today is because this sutra is known for the fact it's spoken by a bhikkhuni. So in the sutras here, they're mostly the teachings of the Buddha, but also the great monks, and in this case, a great bhikkhuni. And as we go through it, you see this is a very profound sutra. This is a real doozer of a sutra. So it just shows you just the huge amount of wisdom based on experience of the bhikkhunis in the time of the Buddha. And there was no equality at that time. So hopefully in a few more years we'll get Sister Wayama even doing better than this one. So here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. This is the Chula Vedana Sutta, the shortest series of questions and answers. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in Rajagaha, in the bamboo grove, in the squirrel sanctuary. Then the lay follower Visakha, this is a man, not to be confused with Visakha, the famous female lay disciple who lived in Sarvati, you know, maybe 300, 400 miles away. This is in Rajagaha, this is the man follower Visakha. And he went to the bhikkhuni Dhammadina. And after paying homage to her, he sat down at one side and asked her these questions. And the commentary says that Dhammadina was his wife before. But she'd left to become a bhikkhuni and became a fully enlightened bhikkhuni to boot, an arahat, Dhammadina. And she was later said to be the foremost in teaching the Dhamma, which you read this and it's obviously pretty much accurate. So the former husband, and by this time he was an anagami, a non-returner, but still hadn't left home. And so you see this is a conversation between a non-returner and a fully enlightened arahat. So this is a very, very high conversation. And so you get some concepts here which are way at the top of the tree as far as Dhamma is concerned. But it's interesting, again, it's because Visakha was the husband, he's still a lay person, and Dhammadina was a bhikkhuni. So first of all, after paying homage to her, so you see that men do sometimes pay homage to their wives, but only when they're fully enlightened and a bhikkhuni. He sat down on one side and asked her, "Lady, personality," he said, "what is called personality by the Blessed One?" Now this is the word sakaya. And it's not used very often, except in its most important form, which is coming up later in the second group of paragraphs, Sakaya Ditti, personality view, which many of you know is that first fetter, the most important of the first three fetters, which you have to overcome to become a screen winner. So Sakaya Ditti, personality view, is very, very crucial on the path to enlightenment. Because that is the main, one of the first three fetters, which when they are abandoned, you are a stream winner on the path to enlightenment. So because of its importance, we're going to start, what is actually said personality view? What do we mean by this personality? And it's important you pay attention here, because even some monks in Thailand, they look at the word, which literally means sakai, literally means with a body. And they think, and I've heard this from some monks in Thailand who, again, should know better, they think the personality view means to identify yourself as a body. As long as you think the mind is something different than the body, then you're a stream winner. Which is, that's not what it means, as you'll soon find out in a few minutes. So what is personality? And I think as you can see from this first set of paragraphs, it really literally means who you think you are.
So if I was translated this, it said, who do you think you are? What is this personality? What is this thing, you know, you take to be Michael or Barbara or Ainsley? Yeah? Yeah, okay. Aha, okay, very good. Comparable, because I have the first edition, you've got the second edition. Identity is probably much better. Okay, let's use identity. Identity, it is said. What is called identity by the Blessed One? Friend, Wisaka. So don't call him husband anymore, because if you're bhikkhuni, you're a friend. These five aggregates affected by clinging are called identity by the Blessed One. That is, the material form, basically your body, aggregate affected by clinging. The feeling aggregate affected by clinging. The perception aggregate affected by clinging. The formations aggregate affected by clinging. And the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. These five aggregates affected by clinging are called identity, or before personality, by the Blessed One. So this is classic Buddhism, the five khandhas, the five aggregates. They're called aggregates because each one of these is not an individual thing, but a group of things. So your body is made up of many groups, even feeling. Feeling, as you would know, is that quality of every experience which is either pleasant or unpleasant or somewhere in between. So there's many types of feelings and many types of perceptions. Perceptions is that when we experience something, we actually take a few qualities of that. That's a man, or so that's a girl, or that's sort of Caucasian, or that's Chinese. So these aspects of your experience, where you sort of perceive some quality in them, and you do ignore other qualities in your perception. So it is only an approximation to a certain description of your experience. That's called perception. And the formations include such things as will, and also thought, and many other emotions are all in this aggregate of formations. And the consciousness, remember, is not consciousness as is usually understood in England. It's the six classes of consciousness: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and knowing consciousness. So you put them all together, and you get an Ajahn Brahm, a Janarato, a Cheng, a Scotty, a Jacob. That's the identity. So that is identity, the five khandhas. And affected by clinging. We'll find out what that means, affected by clinging, in a moment. Saying, good lady, the lay follower Visakha delighted and rejoiced in the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina's words. Then he asked a further question. Lady, the origin of identity is said. What is called the origin of identity by the Blessed One? Friend Visakha, it is craving, which brings renewal of being, is accompanied by delight and lust, and delights in this and that. That is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for being, and craving for non-being. This is called the origin of identity by the Blessed One. And straight away, hopefully, a little bell would ring. So this is the same as the origin of suffering in the Four Noble Truths. Exactly the same. And you see in number four, the cessation of personality or identity is exactly the same as the cessation of suffering. The awakening of the cessation of personality or identity, Eightfold Path. So here you can see the Buddha, or rather Visakha, is actually equating identity with dukkha, with suffering. So instead of the Four Noble Truths, suffering, its cause, its cessation, the way into a cessation, now we've got you, the identity, your cause, your cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of your identity or you. That's a very brilliant way of putting this. It says, you, Scott, are Mr. Suffering. You, Cheng, are Mrs. Suffering. So that's a very interesting way of putting it there. This is why this is by someone who really knows what they're talking about. So, paragraph 4. Lady, the cessation of identity or personality, the cessation of personality or identity. What is called the cessation of personality by the Blessed One? Friend Visakha, it is the remainder of the fading away and cessation, or ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting of that very same craving. This is called the cessation of identity by the Blessed One. So when the craving is given up, the craving which causes renewal of being, which is accounted by delight and lust, that is craving for sensual pleasure, being and non-being, when that's giving up, identity vanishes, the five khandhas stop. And lady, the way leading to the cessation of personality or identity, the way leading to the cessation of personality is said. What is called the way leading to the cessation of identity or personality by the Blessed One? Friend, we sark, it is just this noble eightfold path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. I like stillness instead of concentration. That this is another way of describing the Four Noble Truths. Instead of dukkha, we have personality or identity instead. And the way of the Eightfold Path leads to the cessation of that identity. The cessation of Mr. Scott and Mrs. Cheng. Poof, gone. With the five khandhas disappearing. Including, you know, in the Sankhara is will, your will ceasing. And consciousness, not just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching, but even knowing ceasing. Gone. By following the Eightfold Path. Paragraph 6 is again a very little importance to explanation. Lady, is that clinging the same as these five aggregates affected by clinging, or is the clinging something apart from the five aggregates affected by clinging? Now this is an important part because sometimes people say, oh, it's only being attached instead of clinging. It's only being attached to the five khandhas, which is the problem. If you have the five khandhas but you're not attached to them, then there's no suffering anymore. So is the attachment and the five khandhas different or are they the same? And the answer was, friend Visakha, I'm calling it attachment now. The attachment is neither the same as these five aggregates affected by clinging, nor is attachment something apart from the five aggregates affected by clinging. It is a desire and lust in regard to the five aggregates affected by clinging. That is the attachment here. So remember, desire and lust is actually part of the five aggregates. That's the sankharas. That's actually when you have something, the desire and lust is part of the thing we call the khandhas. And it's also what creates the khandhas in the future. So it's not separate, it's not apart from them. It's part of them, and it also creates them in the future. Cycle, yeah. Here's the chicken separate from the egg. The egg is in the chicken for some time, and then the chicken is the egg later on. Correct, yes. Okay, is it that's the mechanism by which distortion, delusion continues? It's more why we perceive things and we refuse to perceive other things. So that creates delusion, but that is also caused by our delusion. You know, you're a sort of a psychologist, a counsellor, and you go through this a lot when people are in denial. I haven't got hay fever. And, you know, people actually say that, and you see them, and it's because, no, it's obvious they have, but why can't they see it? Because they refuse to perceive that, because it's something they don't want to see. And you know that, you know, you've seen it so many times. And the other thing is that's when our perception is bent by negativity. We just can't see what we really should be seeing. And the other thing is that we see what we want to see. Correct, yeah. So those bend perceptions to present us with what is nice for us to see. It's just like the person who is working for the Prime Minister or the Premier. They don't want to give them the bad economic news. They show them the good economic news. They don't show the polls which show that they're about to lose the election. They present the polls which show you've got a chance. Because then such an advisor becomes popular with the boss.
can see just how wishful thinking and aversion actually do bend the truth. And so, you know, the advisor is this thing inside of us called our mind, which keeps presenting us things which we like to see and stops us seeing what we don't like to see. Especially the sense of self. That's the most frightening thing, to see we don't exist. Well, like I've often said, we're not in control. So, you know, cut off, no, we don't hear that. That's right, yeah, that's what Ajahn Chah used to say. He often could tell the monks, if you come here to die, become a monk, you come to Wat Pa Phong to die. And that's what he asked people. And of course, we thought he was crazy. But that's what he meant. So, and again, with the whole idea of, like, Buddhism, you're in the wheel of samsara, you've gone round and round and round and round and round and round. Have you had enough yet? Yes.
The struggle is exactly the points of craving for non-being and compulsion.
Aha, the craving for non-being. Indeed, yeah. The craving for non-being, I gave a simile. Remember that book which you translated, which was Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond? There's a great simile which I got from Oliver Twist, the book by Charles Dickens. And it's when this fellow, he gave £5 to Oliver to go and pay off his bills at the bookshop. And this man's best friend said, giving £5 to an urchin like that, you're not going to get it back. He said, of course I trust Oliver, he's a good boy, he'll bring it back. He said, if he brings it back, I will eat my own head. And I thought that's a wonderful little threat there, to eat your own head, because then you start thinking about how can you eat your own head? But that's what people try to do with the craving to not be. I am trying to destroy me. And because it's me trying to do this, I can't do it. It's impossible. In the same way, it's impossible to eat your own head, because you need a mouth to eat your head, and your mouth is part of your head, so it just cannot be done. So the craving for non-being is so similar to eating your own head. It cannot be done. So that's what it is. So the cessation is the letting go of trying to do anything, and then you cease. Not trying to cease, but letting go of trying. As you know, this all fits in with the way we teach meditation. You try and make your mind still, no way you can do it. I joke to the monks, now I put my hand up, I can't meditate for my life. I can't meditate. I have to get out of the way, and then meditation happens. But I, Ajahn Brahm, me, I can't do it. I, me, the doer, the trier, that has to vanish. And then meditation happens. Get the point? Very good. Now, we've got, so this is, I'm glad you've all got this. So this is identifying, you know, the identity or personality with suffering, which is, that's really sort of quite mind-blowing, to say that when there's you, there's always suffering. So you've got to disappear. And of course, you know, it's only five aggregates, there's nothing in there, so you're not losing anything. Didn't have anything to begin with. So, already we're getting deep into stream-winning territory. Yes, Daniel? Five cantos. Aha, now we have, that's personality is five khandhas. Personality view is coming up in the next paragraph. So your question is now going to be answered by the great bhikkhuni Visakha. But. So hold on a bit and ask the question after this one. How does personality view come to be? Here, friend Visakha, an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones is unskilled and undisciplined in a Dhamma, who has no regard for true men, is unskilled and undisciplined in a Dhamma. So this is actually the non-Aryan, people who haven't seen the Dhamma yet. They're called Putujana, the ordinary folk. They regard material form as a self, or a soul if you like, or self as possessed of material form, or material form as self, or self as possessed of material form. Also, I've repeated myself there. Let's try it again. They regard material form as self, so material form is the same as self, like the body is you, or self is possessed of material form, so you're the owner of your body. Or material form is in self, so not as the owner, but that the soul is somehow in the body, like the idea of your self and soul is somehow in your brain. It's sort of somewhere inside of that. Or as, that's like this. He regards feeling as self. This is where we identify ourselves with our feeling. I am hurting. I am happy. Or self as possessed of feeling. I have my happiness as my possession. Or my suffering. I own it. Or feeling as in self. In other words, the Vedana is somehow sort of contained as an attribute of yourself, or the self is somehow in the feeling. He regards perception as self. Completely that what you perceive, that you are the perceiver. Or self as possession of perception. This is an attribute of a self, it perceives. Or perception as in self, is included in it somewhere. Or self is somehow included in perception. He regards, instead of like formations, I'm going to call will. He regards will as me. Or me as possessed of will. Or will as somehow included in a soul or self. Or self as somehow included in will. He regards consciousness as somehow within a self. Oh, sorry, no. Regards consciousness as a self. I am the knower. Or somehow the self is possessed of consciousness, that I have knowing as one of my attributes. Or consciousness as in self, as the soul is somehow bigger, and somehow these things are inside this self or soul, with all the other five khandhas. So your self or soul is huge, and within that you have these attributes of the khandhas, but you are bigger than them. Or self as in consciousness, so that somehow in this conscious activity there is a seed of a soul, of a self. This is how personality view comes to be, and this is all stated as delusion. That's pretty comprehensive there. You can't get around having a self anywhere outside of all those possibilities. So this is why, when this Visakha, sorry, this Dhammadina was one smart bhikkhuni, teaching in a way that no one can actually wriggle out of the fact there's no one in there. How does personality view not come to be? Here, friend Visakha, a well-taught noble disciple has regard for noble ones and is as skilled and disciplined in the Dhamma, whose regard for true men and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, in other words, who's at least a stream winner, or higher. They do not regard material form, such as your body, as their self, or their self as possessed of material form, as one of its attributes, or material form as in the self, or self as in material form. Does not regard feeling as self, or self as possessed of feeling, or feeling as in self, or self in feeling. Does not regard perception as self, or self as possessed of perception, or perception in self, or self in perception. He does not regard formations, such as will, thought, emotions as self, or self as possessed of formations, or formations as in self, or self as in formations. Doesn't regard consciousness as a me, a self. Or self as in consciousness, or self as possessed of consciousness, or consciousness as in self, or self as in consciousness. So of each of these khandhas, you don't regard yourself as these things, either individually or together. You don't regard yourself as somehow greater than these khandhas. So when these khandhas disappear, there's something left. That will be you're possessed of consciousness and these other things. Or as these things as inner self, which is pretty much the same as number two, that your body, your feelings, perceptions, your formations such as will and thinking and emotions, or your consciousness is somehow contained in this bigger self. Or that somehow, and this is just for completion, but the most unlikely of these concepts, that you are sometimes contained inside of these things. That is how personality view does not come to be. That's pretty extensive, and that shows you what is necessary to be a stream winner. You realize inside, outside, whichever way you look, there's not a me anywhere. There's not some sense of self which is somehow outside of the five khandhas, nor the sense of self as equivalent to the five khandhas, or somehow you own these five khandhas, or self somehow hiding in some aspect of the five khandhas. There's no way out. It has to be non-self. It's brilliant. Any question about that? Yeah. I like your term. Does that herald the end of those relationships? You can't think of yourself as I am the son, I am the daughter, I am the mother. It heralds it. In other words, it's the beginning of the end of those relationships. When those insights actually come, and it is a shocking insight to see that, it's easy to say, but the ramifications are immense. You know, one really does see that. This beautiful the Dhamma is, you know, just there's no way out. There's no wiggle room at all to have some little place where you can, as I say, hang the hat of me someplace and exist. Because of that, I realize that, you know, that there's no self in there, and once one accepts that, the end is nigh. Seven lifetimes at most. So it's heralded. And as the insight starts to permeate, you know, your cognitive processes, as you start to remember that as a truth, much more than cognizing as you have been habitually doing beforehand. You know, you realize it's true. This isn't my mother. This isn't my father. And I've mentioned to a few people that it explains the relationship I now have with my mother, because I went to go and see her last week in London. She has severe Alzheimer's now, so she doesn't recognize me from the electrician. So she is my mother because I recognize her, but I'm not her son. So you have these amazing relationships, one way, not two way. And of course eventually there's no way. So she's the it's not your mother, it's not your father, it's not your sister, it's not you. It's just a process. Yeah. Oh yeah, but the thing is that what happens with people with Alzheimer's disease, it's a brain dysfunction. It's not a wisdom happening to the mind. Which means that at the end of their life, just before they die, when the mind separates from the body, and then they get all the memories back. Yeah, of course they do. just pass away, yeah. And that's, there was one of the little videos which somebody gave me some years ago. It was about this, and they'd done on the BBC. They always have these weird cases, and every now and again someone sees it on the TV, videos it, records it, and lets me see it. And there was a man in England who, something happened, they found him on the floor, and when he came to, he lost all his memories from the past. Now, from that moment on, he could remember. Nothing wrong with his memory from that moment on, but before that occasion, he didn't know what had happened at all. He'd been married a couple of years ago, a second marriage. He couldn't remember his wife, didn't know where he lived, his name, or anything. That had to be retaught to him. It was retaught to him, and his memory was okay from that time on. He could, you know, was told, that's your wife. Oh, that's my wife, but I can't remember the marriage day or going out together. You know, this is your name, but he can't remember anything before that time of this accident. And in the documentary, they put him under hypnosis. And under hypnosis, he remembered everything. He'd been in his workshop in the back garden, and the telephone had rang before the days of mobile phones, so he didn't have one. He ran out of the workshop, and the shutter of the workshop was open. He hit his head on the workshop. He knocked out his memory. He remembered everything under hypnosis. Perfect recall. So they told him, no, post a hypnotic suggestion, you remember everything when you come out. So they brought him out of hypnosis and he couldn't remember a thing. But in hypnosis it was all there for him. So, under Alzheimer's, as I understand it, and I'm pretty accurate on these things, it's just, it's almost like, when I was young, I got drunk many times. And when I was in a stupor of drunkenness, I didn't know who I was or, you know, where my home was. So, but that was only a temporary sort of dysfunction of the brain. But when I came... Yeah. Exactly, that's what I'm saying, yeah. So their memories come back just before they die. So, you know, it's a brain dysfunction. The brain is blocking out the mind, but at the time of death, the mind gets free of the brain. So you have all your memories back. Okay, so where do we get on to now? Okay, personality view doesn't become to be. So, this is what it means being a stream winner. You don't think that, you know, just the five khandhas of a self. You know the five khandhas are not a self, but there's something else apart from the five khandhas, and that's me. You can see from this, that is negated. If you think that there's a self, an original mind, a cosmic consciousness, you agree the five khandhas aren't me, mine, and self, but you think something else is. That's still not... you still got Sakkaya Ditti, you still got personality view. Yes. Personality view is the biggest of the delusions. Enemy number one. That's part of it. That's a big one. Correct. Correct. And once you have an identity, there's ownership, there's craving. There's all the sort of problems of life. Very good. Have you got a question there? Yeah. Yes, it is, but once the three fetters are gone, that's the thing which underpins everything. It's like the keystone of a bridge. Once that's taken out, everything else falls down. It's like taking off the belt of your trousers. The thing which holds them up. And sooner or later they're going to fall down. There's still the whole trousers to go down there, but once you've got the belt off, it's not going to stay up much longer. Sure, she can function, but not in... Not, of course you can, but not in the same way as before, and it comes a time. the more that that view permeates and becomes you, you know, in the sort of sense of becoming you, is, you know, how you function, then you're on the way out. Which is why the more, once you start to see these things and it really starts to get into you, you can't stay living in a house. Gravity. Run the streets, yes, yeah. There's nothing for you. It's where you belong. You know, on the, I call the monasteries the exit lounges. Just like, you know, in the airports, you know, you're going to Gate 23 and Gate 24 and over to Singapore, London. So you, and as you're, before you board the plane, you have to go into the gate. And those are sort of, those lounges are like sort of monasteries. Before you board for out of this universe. One of those very good questions. If you've ever been a stream winner and then you're a baby, remember there's been a big hiatus, you know, in your consciousness. Being born is just like being drunk, because you haven't got the brain function in the early years, you know, to make use of this, in the same way that the Alzheimer's just makes you forget things. So the very early years, you know, of your brain as a kid makes you forget a lot. It is a blockage of your mental processes, because you've got this baby brain to work with. So it takes a long time, you know, for the streaming and the wisdom which you had before to permeate back in again. It has to come. And so because of that, we often say that if you were a streamer in your previous life, when you were a baby, you know, you're just an ordinary baby, an ordinary kid, you know, maybe just a wiser and more ethical kid than the other kids in your class, but nevertheless, you know, there's nothing really that special about you, but you have to re-experience the attainment. Eventually it just has to come, and you see that you're not a self again, then you carry on. Correct, yes. So, Shimani, yes. You re-experience the same attainment, you have to. So basically you become a stream winner again. And then you carry on your journey. Irreversible, yes. Of course it is, irreversible. Once you've seen the Dhamma, you can't go backwards. That's why, if you want to get out now, get out while the going is good. Otherwise, too late now. No, I'm afraid not. They're done for. They can be. Yeah, I mean, there's no real good place, is it? It's even in heavens and stuff. After a while, you have to fade away. You're out. Only if somebody loves you. But then you're out. You have to be out. It's like being on death row. You can have many appeals. But if it's in California, you're on death row. So, that's already, you can see, pretty deep stuff. Now we have the Noble Eightfold Path. Friend Visakha. It is just this Noble Eightfold Path that is right view, right intention, right speech. So, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. Lady, is the Noble Eightfold Path conditioned or unconditioned? Condition is maybe constructed, formed. Friend Visakha, the Noble Eightfold Path is conditioned. It is formed. It's not the unconditioned. The path is not the destination. Friend Visakha, is conditioned. Lady, are the three aggregates included by the Noble Eightfold Path, or is the Noble Eightfold Path included by the three aggregates? The aggregates here means the aggregate of virtue, stillness, and wisdom, sila, samadhi, panya.
So asking is sila samadhipanya, virtue, concentration and wisdom, that's what it's usually called. Is that part of the Eightfold Path? Is the Eightfold Path part of sila samadhipanya? And he says these three aggregates, sila samadhipanya, are not included by the Noble Eightfold Path. They're not inside the Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path is included by the three aggregates. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. These states are included in the aggregate of virtue, of sila. Right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration or stillness. These states are included in the aggregate of concentration. Right view and right intention. These states are included in the aggregate of wisdom. So it's just actually how this threefold practice includes things. Now, sometimes that I've mentioned when in trying to bridge the gap between such things as Theravada and Mahayana, I say the Eightfold Path is included in Sila Samadhipanya. And if anyone knows the path of a Mahayana Bodhisattva is the six parami, the six perfections, three of which are perfecting Sila, Samadhi and Panya. So even the Bodhisattva path includes the perfection of the Eightfold Path. And the Buddha often said, again and again, that the Eightfold Path leads to Nibbana, leads to being an Arahant. So any Bodhisattva who actually practices those perfections will become an Arahant, whether they like it or not. That may not be what they're aiming for, but what they do, this is how it will end up. Now, Samadhi, or stillness. This is paragraph 12. Lady, what is samadhi or stillness? What is its basis? Actually, this is interesting. What is its nimitta? What is the equipment or the things which help it along? And what is the development of samadhi? And it said, unification of mind, friend Visakha, is stillness. Now this word, unification, is a word which we often talk about in the monasteries, ekagata. Have one of the monks adopted that as his monk name, ekagata. It literally means, eka is one, and aga means chief or peak, and ta means literally in the English ness. It means one peak or one summit ness. And it's something which is often missed out in translation. The idea is not just one point, it's one special point, one very high and superlative point. Everybody will know the word agga from its Sanskrit form, which is Agra. You know what Agra is? It's that great town in India which was the seat of the Mughal Empire. It literally meant capital, peak. It was the peak of power, that's why I call it Agra. So, what is samadhi? It is this one big pointedness, huge summit of the mindness. One summitness of mind, when everything comes together into a peak of experience. What is the basis of concentration? The four kinds of striving, I call that the right efforts, are the equipment of concentration. Now remember, effort, striving is not a good word because that means a sort of doing something. Anyone who's heard me speak before, it's the effort to stop, the effort to renounce, the effort to let go, the effort to give up. Not the type of effort which starts new things, the type of effort which stops things. Do you understand what that effort is? You've experienced it in your meditation. If you strive in meditation, even to watch the breath, your mind gets so unpleasant you can't stay with it very long. But if you stop the striving, the effort to stop striving, if you like, then the mind stays with the breath with the greatest of ease. The right efforts are very subtle. That's why they say they go against the stream of craving.
they stop it. So think of the effort to stop. The effort which doesn't put your foot on the accelerator and press it to the floor. But the effort which puts the foot on the brake. The effort to stop. That is the equipment of samadhi. And the repetition, development and cultivation of these same states is the development of concentration there. So in other words, develop it, just keep on re-experiencing it. And following it, making much of it, developing it. So when the stillness comes, you don't throw that away. You're not afraid of it. You don't think, oh my goodness, I'll be attached to stillness. I must sort of give it away. You keep it going, develop it, make much of it, keep on repeating it. And that's how it's developed. So to develop samadhi, keep on experiencing it, and it develops by itself. Samadhi. Now if you think this is deep, it's going to get a lot deeper yet. This is a bhikkhuni, just really going for broke, brilliant stuff. Lady, how many formations, sankhara, are there? There are these three formations. This is the fourth kanda. But it's also it's part of like karma formations as well. So sankhara is this, it's a very important term which goes into many cases, many areas of the Dhamma. There are these three formations, friend Visakha, the bodily formation, verbal formation and mental formation. But lady, what is the bodily formation? What is the verbal formation? What is the mental formation? And here she sort of says something which is interesting because it's not expected. In-breathing and out-breathing, friend Visakha, are the bodily formations. Applied thought and sustained thought are the verbal formation. Perception and feeling are the mental formation. And straight away as a meditator, when I see that, she's using formations in the context of meditation, especially the path into samadhi. And especially for those of you who know the Anapanasati Sutta, where the fourth step is calming the bodily formations. Calming the breath. This is what it said, in-breath and out-breath. It said calming the mental formations, the citta sankhara, that is number 8. Calming the feeling and perception. These are all important in the path of meditation. So these are those particular formations in the context of developing meditation. So in-breathing and out-breathing, why are they? Why are in-breathing and out-breathing the bodily formation? Why are prior thought and sustained thought the verbal formation? Why are perception and feeling the mental formation? Friend Visakha, in-breathing and out-breathing are bodily. These are states bound up with the body. That is why in-breathing and out-breathing are the bodily formation. First one applies thought and sustains thought, and subsequently one breaks out into speech. That's why applied thought and sustained thought are the verbal formation. That's the old word vitaka vichara. Perception and feeling are mental. These are states bound up with the mind. That is why perception and feeling are the mental formation. Now, you can keep that in mind because they come up in a moment. So these are the ways, calming all these things down, you get into the jhanas and you calm it down even further. Lady, how does the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling come to be? Now this is the cessation of perception and feeling, the mental formations. This is the cessation of the mind. Cessation of your consciousness and your will, everything. Okay. Because they're put in the verbal formations, because they cease first. They are gross mental formations. Yes, and then the path into meditation. The bodily formations disappear first, then the verbal formations of thought, then the mental formations cease. So we're going in the path of meditation as a ceasing of you. The ceasing of your identity. So in this particular context, They're splitting up bodily formations because they cease earlier than the mental formations. Don't have mental chatter. You don't have verbal chatter, but you still have the sustained thing, but you don't break into the verbal speech. It is that potential that vitaka vichara, the movement and holding on to things. It is the pre-verbal thoughts. There's no perception and thought because that's more refined. In the grosser forms, the vitaka vichara will give rise to thinking. As you let go of that thinking, that subverbal aspect of thinking, the vitaka vichara, still remains. It even remains in its most refined form in the first jhana, where you just onto the bliss, you just hold it. A movement of the mind, which in its coarser form is a course of thoughts and speech. Potentially, that's the most refined part of that aspect of thinking. Subverbal, because it's so refined, it's not strong enough to get that far. But it's still there. And that is let go of in the second jhana. Vitaka vichara is gone. Perception and feeling are still there. Now they're going to disappear. Subverbal, it means that it's not capable of breaking out into a thought as we know it. But it's almost like a potential thought. It's like a seed which doesn't germinate. Attention, very good, excellent. Attention is good. Attention which is not strong enough to actually to gestate into a thought. Correct, yeah. That's good, yeah. That's it in practice. Okay, so the attainment of cessation. How does the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling come to be? With perception and feeling gone, can there be any consciousness? Of course not. This is also the cessation of consciousness. Fenway Saka, when a bhikkhuni is attaining the cessation of perception and feeling, it does not occur to them, I will attain the cessation of perception and feeling, or I am attaining the cessation of perception or feeling, or I have attained the cessation of perception and feeling. But rather, their mind has previously been developed in such a way that it leads him to that state. That's brilliant. So this is automatic pilot. You're not sort of saying, I shall attain the cessation of perception and feeling. Any thought and will like that, no way can you stop things. You're actually creating more stuff. Or even, I am attaining these things. Even that degree of perception is so coarse. No way can you cease. But your mind has been previously developed. It's the inclination of letting go. You've been renouncing so much, this renouncing becomes like a momentum. So you renounce, you just renounce a whole lot. And the momentum of renouncing takes you into the cessation. That's the best way I can. In Mindfulness Bliss and Beyond, which Jacob did a lot of work on that, trying to find similes for these states is very difficult, but I got a few ones. And I said it's like running into a room with such a slippery floor. So once you run in, so once you're in those rooms, you can't sort of stop, you can't sort of go back, you can't make up any more sort of acceleration. You just slide through. If you've got a lot of momentum, which you build up outside of these jhanas, as you slide through, you can go in the first room, second room, third room, fourth room, right into the end room, which is cessation. It's the inclination, the momentum which you've got beforehand. Once you're in, you can't do anything. So if you only go into the jhana experience with only a small amount of momentum, you just go into first jhana, that's all you can do, and you come out again. But you can't go into first jhana and say, now I'll get into the second jhana. Inside, the floors are too slippy to do anything. So, these are imperfect similes, but it's the best you've got. When a monk is attaining the cessation of perception and feeling, which states cease first in him? The body formation, the verbal formation, or the mental formation? Friend, when a bhikkhu attains the cessation of perception and feeling, first the verbal formation ceases, so I should have got that the other way around, then the body formation, then the mental formation. So, when you're meditating, thoughts finish, and then your body disappears, when the nimitta comes up. And then, later on, your mind disappears. The great disappearing act. Or even David Copperfield can't make himself disappear. He can make Jumbo Jess disappear, so I've heard, but he can't make himself disappear. So this is much better than David Copperfield. Is he still going? I don't know. Then, Visakha, when a person is attaining the cessation of perception and feeling, first the verbal formation ceases, then the body, then the mental formation. How does emergence from the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling come to be? Then, Visakha, when a meditator is emerging from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, it does not occur to them, I shall emerge from the attainment of cessation of perception or feeling, or I am emerging from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, or I have emerged from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling. Rather, his mind has been previously been developed in such a way that it leads to that state. The inclination is sort of to get in, has it been exhausted, and now the inclination takes you out again. Hi, so yeah. That's right, yes, yeah. So his inclination takes it. Oh, no, he did come at it naturally when he wanted to. He wasn't brought out at all. They were trying to take him out, they just couldn't do it. He just came out when his inclination to come out, when the momentum finished. And he was right there in the one of the emergency rooms, the Charlie Gardner's. He just opened his eyes and bent up. At that point, beep, beep, all the machines started working perfectly again. He was no longer a flatliner. So there's great stories. The best story was that Vietnamese monk recently in Australia, a 9-day retreat. You've been to 9-day retreats. You know what happens, and they do a meditation first of all, and then sort of there's a talk afterwards, and then some question and answer, everyone goes to bed, and then you get up for the next day. This monk, after an hour, he hadn't come out of his meditation. 2 hours, still not out of his meditation. 3 hours, no talk, no precepts, nothing. So they all went to bed. They got up in the morning, he was still there, sitting, hadn't moved. He was like that for 9 days. Never went to the toilet, never took any food or drink. Just was sitting there for 9 days. Didn't move. And afterwards he apologized for not giving any talks. And apparently everyone said, that was the best talk we could ever have, just seeing you just absolutely still for 9 days. Wow. So his inclination, he could do anything about it. He just went in, and when the inclination, say, when it was a huge inclination to let go, and when he came out, it just came out, and he was just a bit disappointed it was too late to give a talk. Yes, Daniel. That's just karma. Yeah, so the life force is not exhausted yet. Yeah, different than asavas, yeah, because the asavas, the inclination to go out into the world has been gone. So it's just like the life force has not been extinguished yet. It's not the time for them to go. No. Well, the mind moves, it's its nature to move. Without movement, there's no mind. Without movement, there's no mind. But it's not there. Intention to move the mind, it just happens automatic again. Lady, when a meditator is emerging from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, which states arise first in him? bodily formation, verbal formation, and mental formation. When a person is emerged from the attainment of cessation, perception, and feeling, first the mental formations arise, the perception and feeling, then the bodily formation, the body comes back, then you start thinking and willing, verbal formation. Later, when a meditator is emerged from the attainment of cessation and perception and feeling, this is a brilliant question, how many kinds of contact touch him? What's the sort of perceptions and ideas which first come up into the mind? Venuvisaka, when a meditator is emerged from the attainment of cessation and perception and feeling, three kinds of contact touch him. This is the first thing which occurs afterwards. Voidness contact, signless contact, and desireless contact. And voidness is this is the euphemism for non-self, emptiness. Signless is anicca. The things have disappeared. The sign which gives them existence is no longer there. They've vanished. The anicca, which is another type of vanishing, and the desireless. See that when these things are gone, they're wonderful. When they're back again, it's a pain in the butt. So these are always voidness, signless, and desireless. Always associated voidness with non-self, signless with anicca, and desirelessness with dukkha. The three signs of existence, anicca, dukkha, anatta. So these are the first thing which hits you when you come out. Anatta, first of all. That's the main one. Anicca and dukkha. Lady, when a meditator's emerged from the table of cessation, perception, and feeling, to what does their mind incline? What does it lean? What does it tend? Friend, when bhikkhu has emerged from the table of cessation of perception and feeling, their mind inclines to seclusion. Well, not just physical seclusion, mental seclusion, actually just basically go back again. Begins to seclusion, tends to seclusion. You don't get any deeper teachings than this. Now we go to something a little bit more easy to understand. Lady, how many kinds of feeling are there? This is Vedana, not the emotional feeling we have as the meaning of the word in English, but the Vedana. Friend Visakha, there are three kinds of Vedana: pleasant Vedana, painful Vedana, and neither painful nor pleasant Vedana. But lady, what is pleasant Vedana? What is painful Vedana? What is neither painful nor pleasant Vedana? Venuvisakha, whatever is felt bodily or mentally as pleasing, as soothing, is pleasant feeling. So this is those pleasant experiences with all of the five, six senses. Yeah. Come on, bird. Oh, beautiful sound of the bird. Isn't that pleasant? If it's a crow, unpleasant crows making all that noise. Yeah, whatever it is, it's with the pleasure or the pain, which is with every sensory experience. That's pleasant Vedana. Whatever is pleasant and soothing. Whatever is felt bodily or mentally as painful, as hurting, is painful feeling. Whatever is felt bodily or mentally as neither soothing nor hurting is neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So this is standard definition of what Vedana is. Lady, what is pleasant and what is painful in regard to pleasant feeling? Ooh, this is good. What is pleasant and what is painful in regard to the pleasant feeling? So it's not just simply pleasant feeling, it's got some aspect which is unpleasant. What is painful and what is pleasant in regard to painful feeling? What is pleasant and what is painful in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Venuvisakha, pleasant feeling is pleasant when it persists and painful when it changes. So the pleasant feeling in the heaven is laden with pain. As soon as it changes, it's pain. And this is where I've often said that all painful feeling is just the space between two pleasant feelings. Because when the pleasant feeling goes, that is called pain. If you're one of these gourmets who has some money and the means, actually no, this is another better simile. I remember just reading about Prince Charles, who would always go first class. And I think because the British government were not so happy with him, or the British people, one day he couldn't go first class, so he went business class. And he complained how hurtful and how unpleasant it was to be in business class travel. Because for him, he was usually in first class, and when you're downgraded to business class, oh, I mean, that just really hurts. So you can see that when painful, pleasant feeling ends, that's painful feeling. Now, you know, the likes of you and I, if you go into business class, oh, that's just so nice. Because economy class is painful. When painful feeling finishes, you get upgraded to business class. Oh, that's nice. That's pleasant. So you see, it's pleasant or pain from what went, what came before. It's not inherently pleasant or painful in its sense, in itself. It's totally conditioned by what came before. Same, yeah, relative. So there's no such thing as inherently pleasure. And if you get a high sense of state of pleasure for so long, I was going to say the guy who goes to the 5-star restaurant, and one day he has to go to a 4-star restaurant because the 5-star restaurant is closed. That is suffering. So, what have we got here? So pleasant feeling is pleasant when it persists and painful when it changes. Painful feeling is painful when it persists and pleasant when it changes. So a person who is in a prison being tortured, if one day you don't have any torture because the torturer goes on holiday or falls sick, then even though you're in prison, even maybe just with an aching body, that is pleasure for you. Neither painful nor pleasant feeling is pleasant when there's knowledge of it, and painful when there's no knowledge of it. Ooh, that's really deep. So, it's pleasant when you have mindfulness of it, and how many of you, when you're really dull, don't like it? When you have no mindfulness of this even feeling, it's a suffering there, because you like to be aware. Underlying tendencies. What underlying tendency underlies pleasant feeling? What underlying tendency underlies painful feeling? What underlying tendency underlies neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Frame Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust underlies pleasant feeling. It's almost a tendency there. Where does it grab you if you continue too long? The underlying tendency to aversion underlies painful feeling. And the underlying tendency, similar to ignorance, to delusion, underlines this neither pleasant nor painful feeling, because it's not enough to stimulate you to actually to learn to understand. 26. Does the underlying tendency to lust underlie all pleasant feeling? Does the underlying tendency to aversion underlie all painful feeling? Does the underlying tendency to ignorance underlie all neither painful nor pleasant feeling? For Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust does not underlie all pleasant feeling. So you can't say all pleasant feeling is bad or wrong. It's only those where the underlying tendency to lust can actually grab you. So if you have a pleasure where there's no underlying tendency to lust, go for it. It's safe. Of course, you should know what that is by now if you listen to me long enough. The underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie all painful feelings. There's some painful feelings which are safe. The underlying tendency to delusion does not underlie all neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Lady, what should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling? What should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling? What should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling? The underlying tendency to lust should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So you're not really supposed to be abandoning the pleasure or the pain or the in-between, because that's life. We're supposed to be abandoning the underlying tendencies to lust, to aversion, to delusion. Dalia. That's coming soon. I haven't yet because it's coming down here. Okay. When there's no knowledge of it, it's just basically you're dull, unmindful. People experience such sloth and torpor. It's a very unpleasant state. And the reason is, yeah, you're dull, you're sleepy, and you're just not really aware. And why is that? Why is the pain in that? It's because you want to be in control, be alive. It's the tendency to be and to be in control, which is absent from you, which is the pain. We're afraid to be dull. Afraid to be dull. They're called depression, many of them, and they hate it. Yeah. What if I feel really dull? Good. It's usually painful. That's why people want to get out. They want to stimulate themselves, have a cup of coffee, get bright, alert. Yes, in the back? Boredom. Yeah, boredom. People don't like being bored, yeah. Round in circles again. It's a process. When you're deluded, it causes you boredom, which makes you more deluded. It causes more boredom. That's why depression, you know, is like a pit which you go deeper and deeper into. You get depressed about being depressed. Yeah, well, if you get that desire to get some action, you do it in the right way, you're out. You start stimulating yourself. Yeah. Okay, let's go further. Lady, does the underlying, this is number 28, does the underlying tendency to lust have to be abandoned in regard to all pleasant feeling? Does the underlying tendency to aversion have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling? Does the underlying tendency to ignorance have to be abandoned in regard to all neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Fen Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust does not have to be abandoned in regard to all pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion does not have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling. And the underlying tendency to ignorance or delusion does not have to be abandoned in regard to all neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And here comes the explanation. Here, Fen Visakha, quite secluded from sensual pleasure, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk abides and enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is a part accompanied by movement of the mind onto the object and hanging onto the object with rapture and pleasure born of that seclusion. With that, he abandons lust, and the underlying tendency to lust does not underlie that. So these jhanas are pleasant states. It's a pleasant experience where these underlying lust does not, so the underlying tendency to lust does not underlie it, not associated with it. Therefore, this is one of those pleasant feelings with no underlying tendency, and so nothing needs to be abandoned there. One of the pleasures which is safe. Here, a monk considers us, when shall I enter upon and abide in that base that the noble ones now enter upon and abide in? In other words, how to become enlightened. In one who thus generates a longing for the supreme liberations, grief arises with that longing as a condition. Oh, you feel unhappy because you're not enlightened yet. So that's an unpleasant feeling. With that, you abandon aversion. And the underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie that. So the abandoning of that, so that wanting to become enlightened, it's an unpleasant because you're starting from an unpleasant place. But that type of unpleasantness, the underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie that, because again, you're letting go of things. Here, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a monk enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. With that, you abandon ignorance, and the underlying tendency to delusion does not underlie that. So this is the equanimity of a fourth jhana. That again is perfect equanimity. Underlying tendency to delusion does not underlie that state. So that is an equanimity which is perfectly safe. So that's what they're saying. So all these feelings are pleasant, unpleasant, and in between. Most of them are dangerous. The present one has the underlying tendencies to lust, to desire, to wanting. The unpleasant ones has the underlying tendency to aversion, to hatred, I don't want this. And the equanimity has the underlying tendency to delusion. However, not all of them. They gave examples here, like the jhanas, pleasure, but there's no danger to them. There's no underlying tendency to lust when you get the jhanas. So anyone who says you get attached to the jhanas, don't do it. You can see this is wrong. That is a pleasure which is safe. Enjoy it. And the longing to actually to become enlightened. You know, if you start to, you know, it's good, but you have to sort of understand how to become enlightened by giving up the aversion, but the underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie the aspiration to become enlightened. And an example of the fourth jhana, there is an equanimity where there's no delusion that underlies it. Because this is the first time there is pure equanimity with no dullness, no delusion. This is neither pleasure nor pain. This is, as I said, this is the practice of meditation, is where you abandon, first of all, the verbal formation, then the bodily formations. And now you're abandoning one of the mental formations called the part of the mental formation is called pleasant Vedana, unpleasant Vedana. So the feelings are mostly disappeared now in the fourth jhana. You've still got the equanimous feeling and perception, but the grosser feelings of pleasure and pain, you've gone beyond them now. So this is the first time you can really call it pure equanimity. Oh, no. This is experience gives you insight, not thinking. Yeah. Ignorance is only because if it's equanimity, which the equanimity, as we say, the water buffalo, which was the simile you used. Ajahn Chah used to use that. Water buffalo in Thailand seemed to be so peaceful, just munching grass, never getting upset or angry, spending all day there, just the most peaceful existence. And one of the monks said once, "Oh, you know, those water buffalo, you know, they must have been arahats reborn or something." Ajahn Chah, "Come on, that's not peace, that's stupidity." And he always used to call the water buffalo stupid animals, because they were abiding in delusion. Anyway, we have to move on a bit. We've got, not that long to go, counterparts. What is a counterpart of pleasant feeling? Now, a counterpart means, what's it joined with? What's its partner? So, I like the word partner, because it gives you an idea, you know, man, woman, or a gay lover and his gay friend, or whatever. What is a partner of pleasant feeling? Friend, which is like a painful feeling, is a partner of pleasant feeling. You can't have one without the other. What is the counterpart of painful feeling? Pleasant feeling is a counterpart of painful feeling. What is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Delusion is the counterpart of neither pleasant nor painful feeling. That is usual, most cases. Obviously, it's this one case here of fourth jhana where this doesn't hold. So with neither painful nor pleasant feeling, there's a bit of delusion there. What is the counterpart of delusion? Delusion, we always have like true knowledge is its counterpart. What is the counterpart of true knowledge? Deliverance is the counterpart of true knowledge. Once you have real knowledge, then that frees you from things. What is the counterpart of deliverance, of freedom? Nibbana is the counterpart of deliverance. What is the counterpart of Nibbana? Friend Visakha, you have pushed this line of questioning too far. You're not able to grasp the limit to questions. That's why sometimes people just ask you, why? You know, and then you give an answer and they say, why? And they give an answer and they say, why? You know, kids do that little game. But there's a limit to the limit to questions. for the holy life friendless arc emerges in Nibbana, culminates in Nibbana, ends in Nibbana. If you wish friendless arc, go to the Blessed One and ask him about the meaning of this. As the Blessed One explains it to you, so you should remember it. So, in all of these cases, these sutras, where there is someone other than the Buddha gives a teaching, it's usually the person goes to the Buddha and checks out what they said, was it okay? Even if they were fully enlightened, they always still ask the Buddha to give it the rubber stamp of approval. Then the lay follower Visakha, having delight and rejoice in the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina's words, rose from his seat and after paying homage to her, his former wife, keeping her on his right, which is the way of respect in India at that time, he went to the Blessed One, the Buddha. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told the Blessed One his entire conversation with the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina. When he finished speaking, the Blessed One told him, "The Bhikkhuni Dhammadina is wise, Visakha. The Bhikkhuni Dhammadina has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina has explained it. Such is its meaning, and so you should remember it." In other words, he gave him his full tick of approval, his stamp, great Dhamma. That is what the Blessed One said. The lay follower Visakha was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Now, the reason again, I read that one out, which is, that's a powerful one of the deepest sutras in the whole of the collection here, was because it came from Bhikkhuni. We did a Bhikkhuni ordination a few days ago. And so the people who ask, in Buddhism, is there equality? There was certainly in the time of the Buddha. Not only an equality of sort of opportunity, but an equality of achievement. You can see from this sutta here, which has been preserved for us for 26 centuries, you can see that beautiful sort of teaching there, that's one of the best, deepest ones. For many people, it's just way over their heads. It actually shows you the depth of understanding and achievement of the Bhikkhunis in the time of the Buddha. Brilliant. You had a question? It's a cultural artifact. That's why the reason I'm saying this, because instead of complaining about it, instead of having more confidence about it, instead of saying, "Oh, isn't it a shame we can't do anything about it," we did something about it. So we ordained Bhikkhunis. And that was only a couple of days ago. So we're very pleased with that development. And it just so happens that because things are in your mind, because it's current, that's why I chose this particular sutta today. You may have heard it before. I'm not sure when it was last read out, but it is topical. Really? Okay, well, it's a great one. It's a brilliant one, but you know, you need some meditation experience to understand this one. This is way up there. Any other questions before we finish off? Okay. Okay. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay, that's a very good point you brought that up. Lust does not do justice for the word. It more is like desire. Because lust is used in English for a particular type of desire, you know, the sexual desire. Even though sometimes we do use the word the lust for money, but you know, it's usually the lust means a very intense, usually sexual desire. But the Pali word is just like desire, craving, wanting. So you made a good point there. Thank you for bringing that up. So where it said lust, there, desire, craving, wanting, is that sort of word. Okay, so let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha now.
Arahaṃ Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Abhivādhemi Suvakkhato Bhagavata Dhammo Sāmi. Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghaṃ Namāmi.